Miss Jesse, there's something I'm meaning to ask you.
Yeah, what might that be?
How old are you?
Let's put it this way. I fought for the South.
South?
We lost.
Hello everyone, welcome to episode 55 of the Gore Press Scorecast. I'm Dangerous Jamie, joining me as always is the lovely Sarah. Hello Sarah.
Hello.
So we've had a few weeks off.
We sure have.
A bunch of weeks. I don't know how many weeks it's been, but it's a lot. Like it was February last time we recorded.
Enough weeks to probably call it at least a month now.
Yeah, well it's definitely a month because we didn't record throughout March and it's now April.
Yeah, but saying weeks makes it sound better.
Yeah, so it's kind of like 5 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been lazy.
Yeah, well, like, stuff has happened.
Real life got in the way.
Yes. I went on tour for a week.
Yeah, I moved house.
Did move house. All sorts of stuff. Yeah.
All the things.
All the things.
Yeah.
And in that 5 weeks, I barely watched any movies.
I watched loads.
Did you?
Yeah, for a change.
Cool. Well, we could talk about those in a sec. We're really sorry that we were not here for a bit. But, like, it happens. I am. I'm totally sorry.
I'm sorry.
I mean, in that time...
I'd like to say...
Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, I'd like to say it won't happen again, but pretty sure we've said that before.
Definitely. This is like our third... lengthy hiatus, right?
Yeah.
But we keep coming back, stronger than ever, so...
I don't know about that. We'll see.
Yeah, well, whatever.
We're back. That bit stands.
It does. What was I going to say before?
Don't know. Before I rudely interrupted.
Oh, in that time I launched another podcast.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Because I was jonesing for some podcasty action. And, like, just couldn't make things work between me and Sarah in that time because of my schedule was all over the place and Sarah's schedule was all over the place. So I went ahead and launched the Let's Get Dangerous podcast, which you can listen to over at letsgetdangerous.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
Or you can find it in iTunes.
And I listened to the first two and I've enjoyed it so far. So, yeah.
Let's crack on. Oh, I mean, my band did release a record, so if you want to listen to that, you can do that at throwingstuff.bandcamp.com. There's only like 25 free downloads left, and after that, you have to fucking pay for it like losers. And then next month, it comes out on sweet, sweet vinyl.
Did it actually come out on vinyl?
It's not yet, but it will do next month.
You're actually releasing it on vinyl? That's
pretty
cool.
We're not releasing it. A label is putting it out for us.
Oh. I have a few hipster friends that will probably purchase that.
Nice. So thanks to Mark for me.
Will do.
Yeah. And we made a video. There's a video of us which someone cut together from a house show we played in Southampton. So you can check all that out on our Facebook if you care, which you probably don't, but you might. That's throwing stuff. Just type it in Facebook and you'll probably find it eventually.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah. Only one other thing.
You've got a couple of things.
Hmm? Yeah. Only one other thing I really wanted to bring up before we get into like what we've been doing.
Yeah.
Aside from all that stuff. I got an email today about a Kickstarter fund called Nick and Al Meet the Devil. And it just looks like loads of fun. The video is put together really well. They're looking for 30 grand to produce the film and then also to market it. So like super tight budget. But like these guys seem to know what they're doing. The director, Nick Betcher, is that his name? Did I make that up? Is it Matt Betcher? It's Summit Betcher.
You could have made all of it up for all I know.
Logan Betcher. He, whatever.
That sounds just like it, yeah.
Yeah, sort of. he's a stills photographer. He worked on Inception, like a bunch of other big movies. He's made some shorts. The film that they're making stars, who does it star? Jim Cody Williams, who you recognize from pretty much everything. Don Fry, the MMA guy, is the villain, and he's got a great face. And it just looks like it'd be loads of fun. So go to Kickstarter and find that and give them money, because I want to see this film happen. And
cool.
People with money can make that happen, whereas I can't because I don't have any.
But if you did, would donate.
I would definitely donate. I mean, I might still throw $20 or something their way in a few weeks. Like, you've got a month to do it, so make it happen. So, and with that said, let's kick off what we've been watching or what we've been doing.
Yeah. Well, you said you haven't watched very much, so do you want to do a quick rundown?
I mean, I don't even know what I've watched at all. I've definitely watched a lot of Castle, a lot of Comic Book Men.
A lot of Hot Fuzz.
I've watched Hot Fuzz sort of 4 times in the last day, because I don't know if you don't know this about me, I love commentary tracks, and I love hearing Edgar Wright talk.
Mm-hmm. I knew that bit.
And so there are obviously so many commentary tracks for Hot Fuzz. I watched it without the commentary first. Then I watched it with the Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg commentary, which is great. Then I watched it with the real Fuzz commentary, which is the two real police officers from Wells in Somerset, where the film's shot. Also Edgar Wright's hometown. And then I watched the other commentary with Edgar Wright and Tarantino trying to sort of out-geek each other with essentially a list of movies, and it's brilliant. Like, two guys who really, really know their shit just, like, riffing on each other and just talking about Michael Winner extensively. And it's a brilliant commentary.
Okay.
I've been trying to get hold of the US Spaced box set for the commentaries on that, but I just can't find it for a reasonable amount, and it's really annoying.
Hmm.
Have you? Did you know? You know about the US Spaced box set?
No, I didn't know it was any different, to be honest.
They've got commentaries with Diablo Cody, Kevin Smith, Quentin Tarantino, J.J. Abrams, basically everyone in America who sort of champions space. And I don't know why they get those commentaries and we don't, and it's a bit shitty and unfair.
That is a bit rubbish.
To the point, I've bought Spaced. I've bought 2 different box sets of Spaced in the years since it came out. And I don't want to have to buy it a third time just because like they've got people I like doing these commentaries. It's really quite of a shitty move, I think. So
yeah.
I'm looking at maybe getting these commentaries on the black market. I want to fund some organized crime.
That's how it works.
I mean, that's what the adverts say.
Yeah. And I believe them without question.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
it is quite expensive. Sorry, yeah. Just had a look. Yeah.
So, if you know of a place where I can find those, then do it. Tell me, because I want them. The only other thing, I set myself a challenge over the Easter weekend, which is now the Bank Holiday Monday end of, and that was to play through Half-Life 2 again.
And
it's still fucking amazing. I actually finished it yesterday and I was really annoyed that it didn't take me the whole time. But it's because on Saturday I did a 15-hour shift and probably overdid it a little bit. I got to the point where I just couldn't play anymore. Like, I just couldn't function about 7 a.m. on Sunday morning. So I went to bed for a bit and then picked it back up at about 2.
Jesus.
You know what I'm like when I get into a game? I just can't stop. Yeah. Like, it's just impossible.
I'm kind of torn between admiration and pity.
Did you ever play Half-Life 2?
Not for a while, and not extensively.
So good. Like, there are no cutscenes. Like, the story is just told amazingly, like, through the gameplay. Mm-hmm. And, like, there are moments where it's, like, it gives you, like, ideas of scale without it being, like... Do you know, like, Resident Evil had those awful, like, blocky cutscenes, and the voice acting was pretty terrible. The writing was just pretty shit. And, like, Half-Life 2 just doesn't do any of that. Like, I mean, some of the voice acting's pretty bad. You might recognize all the voices from, like, Bethesda games. There are some, like, big actors in there as well. I say big. Like, Robert Culp shows up and people like that. But, like, it's written so tightly, and the writing is, like... part of the game. It's not, you play for half an hour and then here's a cutscene where we tell you what the next bit's about or what the last bit was meant. And it's just like beautifully put together and it plays amazingly. It's like, it's quite a linear game. It's not open world at all, but like it's got this massive open world feel because the game doesn't spoon feed you where you've got to go next. It's not like a one track. It has a sort of open world feeling about it. And the gameplay is just brilliant. They obviously did a few exciting things on the Source engine that included like seesaw physics and stuff like that. And they put a lot of that in there because they're like, look, we did this and it's fucking great. So let's hammer that in there quite a lot. And I mean, it gets a bit boring sometimes when you've got to do like, when you're onto like the 10th or maybe 11th seesaw challenge. But it's so brilliant that you, I don't know, you can't fault it. It's probably one of the best games ever.
Okay, wow.
And it's what, nearly 10 years old now, and it's just, it, like, the graphics don't look old. The like it looks as good as an early Bethesda game. It's got, it does seem to look like a Bethesda game quite a lot, and it's obviously not because it's what they call Valve, Steam, or whatever. And yeah, it's just fucking brilliant. And if you've never played it, like, it's essentially the basis for all good games that have come since. And if you have played it, go play it again because it's just brilliant.
That's quite the glowing review.
Yeah, that's my bit on Half-Life 2.
Okay.
So give me some of your stuff. What have you been watching?
What have I been watching? What haven't I been watching? Let's have a look. Excision. No, I'm kidding.
Excision. Tension.
For a change, no. Although, on the subject of detention, it's a bit of a tenuous link, but I did get around to watching John Dies at the end.
Oh, nice. What did you think?
I'm not really sure.
Oh, no.
I enjoyed it.
Good.
No. I really enjoyed it, but I'm still not sure what the fuck I watched. I need to watch it again. But more importantly, I want to watch it again.
Well, that's good. That's a good review.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely enjoyed it, but I definitely understood, because obviously when you watched it, you kind of messaged me immediately and said it's kind of detention levels of great, you need to see this.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, I expected something pretty out there. And I can definitely see the comparison, but I didn't necessarily find it quite as easy to follow as I did when I watched Detention for the first time. Yeah, pretty bonkers. But I would definitely come back to it.
I just thought it was amazing. Detention via like David Cronenberg or one of those types, like it's sort of Detention meets Naked Lunch, but like it's, I don't know if it's too detention-y. It just sort of has that very same, a similar attitude is what I think I picked up on. Like a similar thought process behind it rather than like being similar to it in any sort of narrative or writing sense. They're not similar in terms of like anything beyond the batshit and very self-aware and very sort of reference heavy. Yeah, I love John Dies at the End. It's out on DVD and Blu-ray in the UK now, so you should probably go get it.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, definitely a recommend.
Mm.
But I think you maybe need to know a little bit about it before you watch it. Just, I think if you go in completely blind, it might baffle you in the wrong ways.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm
maybe.
Glad I knew a little about it.
I was pretty blind the first time I watched it, and I just loved it.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was starring Paul Giamatti in like a main role, and I thought...
Yeah, I did. He's great, isn't he?
He is great. I love that he's... he's got that sort of... He's almost like... Who's that British actor? Wesley Snipes. What's his name?
Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen, that's it.
Yeah.
Like, I think they have a very sort of similar attitude where, like, Michael Sheen will do these sort of, I don't want to say, like, Oscar-y, but, like, big, serious, meaty roles in, like, these...
Yeah, no, I think you're right with that. Oscar bait, basically.
Yeah, like, very serious films, and then he'll be like, well, I've done that, and now I want to do something different and fun. So here's Underworld 3, or here's, like, me hamming it up amazingly in the Twilight films. He is the only reason to watch the Twilight films.
I've only ever seen the first one.
I think he comes in the second or the third, and he's just amazing. Like, he's like chewing up the scenery, the other actors, like everything. He's just like fully hamming it up, and he's clearly having the best time. So yeah, like, and I think Paul Giamatti is very similar. Like, he'll do these big roles where he plays like John Adams and like Barney's version and Sideways and like these sort of serious, even when they're comedies, they're still sort of fairly serious, and they're very like, I'm wearing glasses and I'm watching this writing notes because it's important.
Yeah, I know what you mean, like proper films.
Yeah, like proper films is a good way of putting it. But then he'll just turn up and do these really daft things because, you know, he's a guy and he likes to have fun.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that about some actors in Hollywood really get it. And they're really...
Yeah, no, and exactly what you mean. That's, yeah. I must admit, the thing you just said about Michael Sheen is the first time anybody's ever said anything that made me want to go and watch any of the Twilight movies.
There's probably a YouTube video where they put all of his bits together. It's like, his bits are so YouTube worthy.
Okay, I might have a look for those later.
He's just amazing. I really love him as an actor as well. Like, in anything. Sorry, I've got a bit of a thing in my throat. He definitely just, like, brings it. Whatever he's doing, he's in there, like, 100%. So cool. We spent a lot of time on John Dies at the End. What else have you got?
I rewatched a bunch of stuff, so I might just reel those off. Rewatched the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie.
Oof.
That was mainly because Phil, who's, if you didn't read it already, he wrote an excellent kind of breakdown of feminism, or I don't know, how female roles are represented in the Buffy series.
Yeah, it was a brilliant piece. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was excellent. So if you haven't read that, go and find it and read it. But he'd never seen the original film, so that was sort of to introduce him to that.
Right, how did he find it?
I don't think he loved it. I think we kind of talked about it afterwards and agreed that you could see a lot of ideas that were honed when it came to doing the TV show.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of it was there, it was just not quite as disciplined.
I guess if you're making a movie as well, there's a lot of voices.
Yeah.
I imagine it's fairly similar in TV, but like, once you get to TV, you're allowed to, if you've got the right team. I think I watched a documentary on one of the box sets of Buffy's special features that basically said, like, when he made the film, people were saying, you've got to do it like this, you've got to cast these people, this is what we need.
Yeah.
And when he came to do it on TV, he managed to have a decent sort of production team within the network that were like, let's just let this be what it is, and let's just let it go. And that's definitely what Buffy needed, because the film was fucking shocking. The film was The film
for
was
all
what
the
let
reasons.
Me what kept me away from the series for so long. Like, I hated the film so much that I just didn't want to watch the TV series at all.
Wow. Okay. I love the TV show, but I also acknowledge that it is... I love the film, but I also acknowledge that it is utterly shocking.
Yeah, it totally is.
It's terrible, but that's kind of why I love it.
Mm.
For that and Paul Reubens' death scene. Yeah, I don't know.
What else?
Rewatches. Right, I rewatched Frozen.
How did that hold up? I rewatched
well,
it.
Actually.
I rewatched it recently as well, so...
Reasonably well. Obviously, it's difficult. As with any film, once you know what happens, it's probably not going to hold up quite as well.
Yeah.
But I still enjoyed it. I still thought it was a good film. I thought there were a couple of bits, I don't know, it's a good film. It's definitely a well-made film. It's pretty solid, but it's also teetering on the verge of tipping into something that might be a good watch with friends whilst drunk, so you can shout at the screen.
Yeah, they do make some pretty bad decisions, don't they?
Yeah. But I still enjoyed it. What did you think?
I mean...
How many times have you seen it now?
I saw it twice. I saw it once at Glasgow Fright Fest, and then I watched it again on DVD fairly recently.
Okay.
And when I watched it at Fright Fest, I obviously loved it.
Mm-hmm.
There's this whole sort of festival audience feeling where films sort of come across quite differently when you're sharing it with a room of like-minded people.
Yeah, definitely.
And I watched it with Andy, who'd obviously he'd never seen it, and he loved it, thought it was great, and like Grim and creepy. And I was like, well, it might be that I already knew the story and how it ended. It might be that I started to notice like little problems I had with it, but I definitely didn't love it as much as when I saw it in Glasgow. It was almost like a very different film. It seemed so like big and like the scale was massive when I saw it at Glasgow, but it was on a big screen. And then watching it on my 32-inch CRT TV maybe like betrays that a little bit, or maybe it's just that like it seemed bigger because it was on a bigger screen, but it definitely felt like much smaller, and like some of the directorial choices didn't come off in the same way that they did when I watched it the first time. So I definitely didn't love it the same way as the first time. It's probably Adam Green's best like horror film or thriller or whatever you would call it.
Yeah.
Like I don't love,
I'd agree with that.
I don't love Hatchet, and I especially don't love Hatchet 2. I haven't seen Spiral, which he co-directed with Joel David Moore, and Holliston's just shot like a crappy sitcom on purpose. But definitely,
I'm
like
surprised
that.
You haven't seen Spiral. Actually, it's very, very different to the rest of his output.
Yeah, I imagine it is. Like, maybe I tried to watch it once and just didn't get through it. I don't remember, but I feel like I've seen chunks.
It's not great, but it's worth a watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of stuff that I've seen, so I'm just going to reel them off, and you stop me if you want to talk about anything, yeah?
Okay.
Okay, because there's a big list. Right, I rewatched a couple of the Broken Lizard films, Slammin' Salmon and Super Troopers. Watched Wreck-It Ralph.
What did you think of Wreck-It Ralph? I'm stopping you right there.
Okay. I really enjoyed it. It's exactly what I expected. 100% ticked all the boxes for that sort of a Disney film. Was it Disney or Pixar?
It was
Disney, wasn't it?
Yeah, Disney. Yeah, Disney.
I really enjoyed it, but it didn't sort of... It wasn't mind-blowing.
I really liked
it. It was definitely entertaining.
The ending is really obvious.
Yeah, of course
it is. I mean, I don't want to spoil it or whatever, but like, did you pick up on the sort of the character and then the character becoming a different character thing? Because like, I called that like in the middle, like... I was like, well, that guy is the other guy, and then
yeah. Yeah, I mean, for sure. It's I don't know, it's a kid's film.
One thing that really annoys me, and it annoys me in lots of films as well, and I'm gonna do a little rant about it here, is when you why hire like name actors to do impressions of other actors? I just don't understand it. Like Alan Tudyk in this is doing an impression of what's his name? It's the guy that plays the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. Was it the Scarecrow or was it the Lion? I can't remember, but it's that guy. And, like, I don't understand why you hire a guy to do an impression. Like, you don't hire Alan Tudyk to do an impression. You hire him because he's Alan Tudyk, right? You don't hire fucking Justin Timberlake to do boo-boo impressions.
No, the only thing that struck me when I watched it was, and I heard his voice, was that he should have been, I mean, obviously the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland was fucking terrible anyway, but he should have been the Mad Hatter. Why wasn't he the Mad Hatter?
Well, doesn't that guy do the voice of the Mad Hatter in the Alice in Wonderland Disney cartoon?
Oh, does he? Oh, which guy? Which one are we talking about?
The guy that he's doing an impression of.
Oh, maybe.
I'm going to check that out, because... I'm going to start at Wizard of Oz. And work,
yeah,
where
while you do that, I'm going to reel off some other titles, because we've been talking for ages. I watched Despicable Me, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, basically because I've kind of, one of my friends sat me down and said, right, you've kind of been missing out on all this great animation.
Love Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah, I did.
One of my all-time favourite animated film.
Yeah, I loved it.
Makes me cry at the end, like properly.
Wow, lame.
You know, daddy issues, Carruthers over here. Like,
but I have to be in the right mood to watch animated films generally, so a lot of this has just kind of passed me by. So I've been trying to make up for that in the past few weeks, and I've loved most of what I've seen, to be honest.
So it is the guy who does the voice of the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland.
Well, maybe it was a subconscious thing. Maybe that's why my brain threw that at me then.
I made that up.
Okay.
But yeah, Ed Wynn, that's the name of the guy. He does a lot of those voices. And it's just, I just don't understand why you would hire an actor, a name actor, to just do that impression.
Yeah.
Like, it just annoys me. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I rewatched the Korean Hansel and Gretel, which obviously we did in like one of the first ever podcasts.
I think it was the second or the third, yeah.
Is it the second, yeah. Still loved it, maybe more so.
I haven't watched it since we covered it. Didn't really like it then.
What else? Rewatched The Guard, 30 Days of Night.
Why did you rewatch The Guard?
Because I love that film.
Wait. No, I'm thinking of The Watch. Okay, all right.
No, I didn't love that film.
Guard is Brendan Gleeson, yes, and Martin McDonagh again.
Yeah.
Right. I haven't seen that. Is it not Martin McDonagh?
It's his brother, I think. Well, which one directed In Bruges? Was that Neil or Martin?
Martin.
Right, it was Neil McDonagh who did The Guard then in that case. I assumed it was the same guy because tonally they're so, so similar. But yeah, it's his brother. I watched an indie horror called The Signal, which was really, really bizarre, but I kind of loved it. And I would really... We should talk about this more after, actually, because I'd really love to cover it in a podcast. I think you'll either love it or hate it, but I think we'll get a lot to talk about.
Well, I think I looked at this when I... Because I watched... What did I watch? What did I watch, Sarah? Tell me.
I don't know.
I watched Pontypool.
Oh, okay.
And I think this sort of came up in a conversation that I was having about Pontypool, because yeah, it sort of... I think it shares some commonality.
Yeah, it does.
And so, yeah. I could watch this. So
okay.
That's, yeah. We could, cool. We can come back and talk about that another time.
Yeah. Small Soldiers, Chronicle, The Punisher,
what did you
Tom
think
Jane
of
one.
Chronicle?
It was the second time I'd seen it. I quite enjoyed it.
Right, okay. I think we might have talked about it before then.
Probably. Yeah, rewatched the Tom Jane version of The Punisher because somebody had linked me to... I can't remember what it's called. I think something like hashtag Dirty Laundry, if you search for that on YouTube. But it's a really, really brilliantly put together fan-made film.
Yeah, with Tom Jane as the Punisher. Like, brilliantly,
yeah.
I thought. Like,
I think they just sort of asked him to do it, and he was like, yeah, fuck it, why not? Because he seems like kind of a cool guy.
I think I think he was looking to get back in for another sequel.
Okay.
After Lexi Alexander, is that her name? Or is that a porn star? Who knows? After she didn't cast him, after they went a different direction with Ray.
Yeah, was it Ray Stevenson?
Yeah, Ray Stevenson in the sequel, which I love that sequel.
Oh, I hated it.
Oh, but it's so much fun. Looney Bin Jim.
It's so ridiculously violent.
Oh, yes, it is.
I didn't like it as a film, though, but it's fun, I suppose.
Like, I want to call Alexi Alexander, but I don't know if that's her actual name. I'm just making that up, but I think she is a great action-y director. Like, she did Green Street, which some people don't like, and I do.
Ah, what?
I like Green Street. Like, really? Accents aside,
firstly, how can you even get past that?
Well, like, do you watch Sons of Anarchy?
Point made. Carry on. Continue.
Yeah. I just think she's great. I don't know what she's been up to. I might search her name now and see what comes up. Lexi Bell? That's a porn star. Lexi Alexander? I fucking got her name right. Get in me. What else has she done? Lifted. What's the fuck's Lifted? Oh, it looks fucking rubbish. Oh, God. 13-year-old Henry Matthews struggles with life after his reservist father is deployed to Afghanistan. With the help of a local pastor, the boy... decides to take part in a local singing contest. Well, I will not be watching that film.
You do surprise me.
Yeah, bad.
I finally got around to watching Dread.
Oh, I watched Dread too. Maybe, did we talk about it already? I don't remember, but I watched it too and I liked it a lot.
I liked it a lot.
I haven't seen The Raid yet, and apparently they're very similar, like incredibly similar, but...
I wouldn't go as far as to say incredibly similar. They have a hell of a lot in common regarding plot. I mean, it's basically the same thing, but the execution is very, very different.
Right.
I really, really enjoyed both, but The Raid pipped it for me.
Well, my problems with Dread is, I mean, I'm a big Dreadhead for like since forever. Like I've been collecting 2000 AD since I was about 9 years old.
Yeah.
The big thing about Judge Dredd for me is Mega City 1 and like the huge expansive city and like how different it is to now and like with all the overcrowding and stuff, and you just don't get the sense of that in Dredd because it all takes place in one, pretty much in one location. I mean, it's a very occupied area, but like they don't run into that many people. It doesn't feel like an overcrowded like block. It feels like just like a normal block of flats.
Yeah.
And that's probably my main problem with it. I think the casting of Carl Urban was great. I think him not taking his fucking helmet off like fucking Sylvester Stallone was great. No matter how much I love the Sylvester Stallone version, which I do.
Oh, what?
It's definitely one version of Judge Dredd. I think he sort of nails some aspects of Judge Dredd really well. Particularly in the earlier part where he's actually wearing his helmet. But like, Carl Urban's face was maybe a little bit thin for me. Judge Dredd's got that.
It just made me think of Grumpy Cat throughout.
Yeah, well, like, the scowl he does, it very much looks like he's like, I am trying my hardest to do my scowliest scowl right now.
He's not chinny enough.
He's definitely not chinny enough. Like, maybe someone like Henry Dean Morgan might have been better, I think.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a great chin.
He does.
Or, like, if they couldn't get him, well, maybe they probably would be able to get him. They couldn't get Javier Bardem because he's... He's a bit more upmarket. Yeah. But yeah. I think someone like Henry Dean Morgan, or maybe even Gerard Butler would have been, like, good. They've got good chins.
Mm, yeah.
You just need a good chin and, like, a gravelly voice. And both of those can pull that off pretty well.
But overall, good film.
Yeah, I thought so. Like, I just wish... I mean, and they're going to make a sequel, obviously.
Well, it wasn't... set in stone to begin with, was it? Because it didn't make very much money.
I mean,
to start,
did it not?
No, not at the cinema. I think it's done really well on DVD and Blu-ray.
Well, they better make a sequel, is what I think. And it better like branch out into the outside world. I think in the early when they first announced this, Dredd, there was talk about including Judge Death. And the Four Horsemen and that whole storyline, which is probably the greatest storyline in Dredd, in like the history of Dredd, it's so good. And there was talk of adapting that and having that as the movie, and that would have been amazing. I don't know how you would do it, and it would take the film in a very different direction because it's obviously there's a whole supernatural. Dimensional sort of travel element to it, and that's very different to sort of the almost realism of Dredd. But that's an amazing thing. I kind of want them to do. I'm getting into like super nerdy territory now. Like, I probably lost most of the people listening, but I'd love to see like a PJ Maybe storyline. He's been consistently my favorite character in Judge Dredd since I was a kid. From him being the crazy teen who kills his foster parents up to him being like the mayor of Mega City 1. He's just a brilliant character. And I'd love to see that tackled in a film. So I'm going to stop talking about Dredd now because I could just go on for hours and hours about Judge Dredd.
Okay. Well, to be honest, I'd be surprised if they didn't do a sequel at some point. But I know there was some doubt cast on it because it didn't do quite so well. As people hoped. I think they missold it, or they undersold it to start.
Yeah.
I think a lot of stuff has been really mismarketed lately, and that was probably one that fell victim to that.
I wonder how much Dredd cost.
I don't think it was a phenomenal amount. I think it was comparatively pretty low budget.
I think $35 million is estimated budget, according to IMDb. And I think if they'd spent more of that money on sets... Mm-hmm. And like building the world, then that world would still be there for the sequel, and the sequel could then cost less money. But because they put it all into like, I don't know where it all went, special effects probably, and slow-mo cameras are really hard to fucking, they're really expensive, so probably went to there as well. They maybe shot themselves in the foot in regards to a sequel because that stuff's just not there now. But that would have been an easier way to drive down the cost of a sequel.
We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope it happens, and I hope it holds up to like my fandom of Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
It's not something I get to talk about an awful lot. And I'm really glad that Dread happened because I get to like whip out my Dread card every chance I get now.
Sweet. Okay. I'm nearly done now. Oh. Fuck. What else have I seen? I watched The Bay, Take This Waltz, the Joe Dante, The Hole. Not the Flora Birch one.
I watched The Hole a while ago and I don't remember anything about it. Was it good?
I loved it. It was that it had that sort of real 80s kiddie horror feel that we've talked about quite a bit lately. Yeah, that isn't like, done enough anymore. So I really, really like that. And I'd watched Compliance, which was weird.
Compliance is the one that I wanted to talk about with you on the Let's Get Dangerous podcast.
I'll stop talking then.
I'm glad that you watched that recently. We can maybe squeeze you in this week.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. I don't know what else I've watched. I've not been really keeping a tally on it lately. I've just fallen off completely on that.
Well, we should probably stop talking now anyway.
Yeah, let's take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about Near Dark because it's totally still Women in Horror Recognition Month or something.
Wait, what film are we doing? What are we covering? Near Dark?
I don't think I've
ever seen that.
It's like a little sort of indie comedy from 1972.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, well, we'll take a break and then we'll see how that goes.
Awesome.
If you fancy dropping us a line at the Gore Press Gorecast, there's a number of different ways you can do that. You can send all your competition entries, feedback and comments to podcast@gorepress.com. If you're on Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/gorecast. Or if you're on Twitter, you can follow us at GorecastX.
Hello, I'm Jim Cogan.
And I'm John Wisby.
And this is a promo for the Crash and Burn movie podcast. Every episode, we pick a theme and review three films each that we like, but fall within that theme.
And then we also take a classic B-movie or some other film that's good for the wrong reasons for our So Bad It's Great slot, and we rip the piss out of it.
So that's the Crash and Burn Movie Podcast every fortnight. You can pick it up at www.crashandburnmoviepodcast.co.uk. There you can subscribe to the RSS feed, you can subscribe in iTunes, you can stream or download the previous episodes, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. It's the Crash and Burn Movie Podcast, www.crashandburnmoviepodcast.co.uk.
Belongs to our world.
We'll give him a week, see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
He belongs to theirs.
I don't want to kill.
He makes a kill tonight.
And they all belong to the night.
It's 3 hours short for a bus to get home. You help me out?
What are you on?
Believe me, I told you.
Don't think of it as killing.
Amen.
Amen. Don't think at all. It's just something that you do night after night. It's only ever a question of time.
You nervous? I would be too if I were you. Near Dark.
Could be your boys falling in with control.
Check out time.
Yourself some time, son.
God damn, this is my family. Let him go.
Near Dark. Pray for daylight. The night has its price.
So we're back and we're talking Near Dark. You just heard the trailer there. It's directed by Catherine Bigelow, starring Adrian Pasdar, Jenny Wright, Lance Henriksen, what's his name? Bill Paxton, Tim Thomason, bunch of people. Joshua Miller. I can't remember anymore. But yeah, it's the story of a kid? I guess he's just a guy. Not really a kid, is he? I don't know how old he's meant to be, because all I see is Nathan Petrelli when I look at him.
Yep, me too.
He is sort of guy who lives and is from the South. He meets Jenny Wright. Jenny Wright's character, May, sort of has a little flirtation with her, becomes a vampire sort of accidentally, and then joins their sort of weird family. Yeah. And then they travel around and then they do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's batshit all over the place.
Yeah.
Vampire sure batshit.
See what you did there.
Yeah, it's clever, that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't even write that down. That was just from my head just now.
Oh, dear. The magic as it happens.
Exactly. He's so difficult. Adrian Pasdar is so difficult to buy as a redneck guy. Mm-hmm. And he's great in this, and he's great at it, but it's so hard to buy him as that character.
Yeah.
I really struggle. I mean, there are a lot of different styles of performance in this film, and they're pitched at various different levels. And I don't know if it damages the film or if it makes it better. I can't tell. Because, like, you've got Bill Paxton playing it to, like, 11.
Yep.
And then you've got Lance Henriksen playing it as he always does at about 3.
But brilliantly so.
Well, like, I mean, it's the Lance Henriksen performance. It's always essentially the same performance. Like, you can't tell Frank Black from Jesse Hooker, apart from in, like, some of the more, like, the bigger moments.
Mm.
He sort of comes across, like, he appears in films like he's a character actor, but he's not a character actor. He's just a guy that shows up and does the same thing every time.
Yeah.
He's almost like a movie star, but he's not a movie star. He's Lance Henriksen. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Like, Will Smith is Will Smith in everything that he's in because he's Will Smith.
Yes.
And Lance Henriksen isn't Will Smith. He's Lance Henriksen. But he gets away with doing that as well.
But he looks like Lance Henriksen, and therefore is not in the same pay grade.
Exactly.
I still love the guy. He's awesome.
No, me too. I think he's great. Like, I really loved Millennium. I thought it was brilliant. And I will have a fight with anyone that says it's not. Near Dark, right?
Yeah.
Before we get into sort of Catherine Bigelow female director territory,
mm-hmm.
of which I don't think there's much to discuss in this because, well, whatever, we'll get to that. This is the only modern vampire love story that you need to watch, unless you want to watch Michael Sheen having it up amazingly, which I showed you a clip of in the break there. And
he did.
Did it make you want to watch Twilight?
Kind of. A little bit, yeah.
He is brilliant. Like, he's so brilliant. But yeah, really, this is the only one that you really need.
Yeah, I second that.
It's very similar when you break it down to, like, the most base plot. It's very similar to The Lost Boys.
I mean, there's probably to any number of vampire films when you look at it at its most elementary level.
Yeah, well, if I summed this up in a sentence and said a guy meets a girl. And then he becomes a vampire, and then, like, he has to, like, run with her little gang of vampires.
Yeah.
That could be either of those films. It could probably, like, you're right, it could probably be, like, 50 of them, but it could definitely be either of those two. And they came out around the same time. I think Lost Boys was maybe a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
But the big difference is in the execution. And you get,
I think they were actually the same year.
Was it 87?
I think so. Should I check?
Go on, do that. But yeah, like, the execution is so different.
Oh god, yeah. Yeah, like, 1987.
Oh well, that's just one of those weird things, I guess.
Yeah. Vampires were big that year, obviously.
Mm.
But yeah, absolutely. They, like, at the most simple level, I guess. They've loads in common, but they all in the execution.
This is probably my favourite modern vampire film.
Yeah, I think I'd probably go along with that. I love Lost Boys as well, but for very, very different reasons.
Lost Boys, yeah, they're pitched to very different audiences. They've got a very different dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess Lost Boys is kind of about, like, holding on to your youth and trying to be young as long as possible, which, I mean, sounds kind of wanky, but I think when you strip it down, that's what it's about. Whereas, like, Near Dark is kind of about trying to reconcile your, like, who you are based on your surroundings and who you're with.
Mm. I think personally, the nostalgia factor, which we've covered at length, probably has a lot to do with why I still love Lost Boys, because I saw that when I was a kid and I didn't see Near Dark until much, much later. So
I think Near Dark is a better film.
Oh, God, yeah. No, that's not even in question. I don't think anybody would disagree, would they?
I mean, someone probably would, but they're probably a prick.
Joel Schumacher might. But we're not asking him.
We're not. Well, he doesn't get an opinion on, like, whether films are good or not anymore.
No.
Like, despite making some great films, he fucked himself right in the nipples.
Right in the Batman nipples.
Yeah.
He sure did.
Right, should we get into some gender politics discussion?
I mean, you can. I'll probably just, like, nod and make agreeable noises every now and again, because it's been weeks and I've forgotten loads.
Right.
And unlike you, I don't make notes, so...
That's true.
Refresh my memory.
I see May as sort of a combination of various different sort of female character archetypes. Mm-hmm. She sort of operates as a damsel, as a honey trap, a love interest, the reluctant anti-hero, like, all at once. And yeah, they're, like, the four... Well, the three... Three of those are, like, the square hole that you fit female blocks into in films in the 80s. Yeah. Apart from, like, a few, like, Aliens and some like that. Like, they're... Aliens would be the reluctant anti-hero. Like, they are the sort of the female character archetypes of the decade.
Yeah.
Her character sort of exists outside the genre. She's the one thing that we recognise in the film that sort of brings us in, much like she brings in Pazdar's character. And, like, she makes... Because she's something that we recognise and we've seen, like, 100,000, however many other times, she makes it seem extra sort of otherworldly, because the other characters, despite, like, we've seen them, sort of seen them, seen shades of them, especially in the Lance Henriksen performance...
Mm-hmm.
You end up with, like, characters like Bill Paxton's character, whose name escapes me, Severin. Is it Severin?
Sounds right.
They're so out there. Like, because she's a part of that, it sort of humanizes what is essentially the villains, although, like, they're not presented as villains by the film. Mm-hmm. It sort of humanizes the villains that, like, in a way that few other vampire films ever manage to do. The film almost plays like an examination of, like, the female role in the sort of the horror genre, and, like, it doesn't really play like a horror film, and that's fully, I think, a lot to do with the way that Kathryn Bigelow directs and the way that she sort of picks and chooses the moments. Like, there are horror moments in this film, but it doesn't. I don't think it plays like a horror film. It plays in a similar way. Sorry, I'll finish this up in, okay, like, 2 seconds and let you talk. Like, it almost plays in the same way that, like, obviously, like, 25 years later or whatever, but, like, the way that The Devil's Rejects is a horror film and doesn't play like a horror film.
Mm.
And they obviously share a lot of common ground as well. I think it's sort of an examination on the genre and where, like, certain character types fit in. And I'm done. I'm sorry, you can talk now.
I was just going to say, like, I think a lot of her films kind of transcend the genre that they're pigeonholed in. So it's only natural that when she turns her hand to doing a horror film, the same would be true. Because, I mean, first and foremost, I guess it is a horror film, but it's a romance. It's almost a Western. It's almost a road movie. It ticks so many boxes. And it's almost like it shouldn't work. Like, when you look at all the different elements, it almost feels like too much. Like, it's almost a bit overwhelming. But she just pulls it together in a way that I don't think anybody else could have done.
Yeah. I don't know if it's because she's a female director. I think maybe any director with like an interest in like the politics of movie making and sort of like an insight into that world could make the same sort of the same points or the same sort of suppositions that she does in the film, and like brings it together in such a way. But she does, and I don't know if that's because she's a female and can present these sort of gender politics in a way that like a male couldn't. I think a male could and has in other films probably, but I think for the most part, female directors have obviously like a hard lined into that area. Like, I think a male director could have made what did we talk about? What's it called? American Mary, but they didn't. It took a female director to tell that story and tell it in such a way that it wasn't a big pile of horse shit.
So basically you're saying that they're like both genders are capable of it. It's just one might have the desire to more than the other.
Maybe not the desire to, but I think you could see a lot of films that are like, that discuss sort of gender politics and gender roles in certain genres. They could be made by either gender. But I think there's something like wired in. I say either gender, like they can be made by anyone. Mm-hmm. But there's something like wired into the female director, especially like one as competent as Catherine Bigelow is, that they can just get it more right than anybody else would. Because being a female director working in Hollywood, this was her third film, I want to say, second or third film. So she'd made films previous. Mm-hmm. She was obviously aware of the system and how it all worked. It's just more like hard coded into her to recognize these things that maybe a male director wouldn't. They might see it from the outside, but they obviously feel very differently about it because we've not mentioned sort of checky privilege type bullshit at all over the films that we covered for this month, of which there was a 5-week gap in between. But like, it's difficult for a male to see a female's perspective without looking at it from a point of privilege, because as men we get treated differently, and anyone that says that we don't is fucking lying. Especially like white male that dominates Hollywood. Hollywood is dominated by white males, and as such are in a position of privilege at all points in their life. I mean, I don't want to get too much into race and stuff like that, but Louis C.K. makes a good point. And like, if you're born white and you're born male, you're pretty much set up. Like, nothing can ever be as bad as anything. So yeah, I'm doing a bit of ranting on this one. I'm sorry.
Rant away. It's fine.
Let's talk about Bill Paxton's performance.
Go for it.
Well, like, what do you remember of it? I mean, I know it's been a good 4 or 5 weeks since we watched this.
Hard to describe, to be honest. It's certainly a lot bigger than most other people. His is the character that almost seems the most out of place.
Yeah.
I would say.
Like, as much as I enjoy watching him work, his performance pulls me out of the movie. But I think because it's been so long since you've watched it and you're not looking at notes, I think that sort of puts us in a quite a good position, because a lot of people remember this film from like when it came out or from having seen it a long time ago. And those sort of the notes of his performance are probably one of the biggest talking points of the movie, I would say. Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of what you remember, like in terms of what he does and how he does it, I guess.
What do you mean, the actor or the character?
The character and the character first and foremost, because it's...
I don't know, he's the most impulsive, I would say. I don't know, to be honest, it's hard to say. How would you describe him?
Well, he's definitely over the top.
Yeah. I mean, not quite to the point of being cartoonish, but like you say, it definitely pulls you out of proceedings. Like, the rest of the characters are kind of... Well, some of them are kind of out there, but not so much as you lose where you are in the film.
Yeah, this is one of the few films where I can enjoy him on like two levels. The level of like he's batshit, and the level of like he just about like keeps it within the framework of like a movie. He's not like in other roles, There was the one that I watched. I can't remember what it was called. It was directed by, he directed Detroit Rock City. What's his name?
Oh, Adam Rifkin.
Adam Rifkin. I had Scott Spiegel in my head and I just couldn't get it out. Yeah, in the film that I watched where he was in it, it was directed by Adam Rifkin. I can't remember what it was called, but it had Judd Nelson and it was fucking weird. And I talked
about it. I remember you talking about it a couple months ago.
Yeah, like in that, he sort of like almost his performance like busts out of the screen and is like taking place on your carpet or whatever. And like, it's to the detriment of the movie, really. Because you're watching Bill Paxton, you're not watching whatever movie it is. And I think that's a problem. And in this, it's one of the few where he manages to do both, because his performance and his character is fairly central to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that it doesn't happen in, say, in Aliens or in other ones. In Aliens, he's just a guy who's there. And he's central to the plot, but like, only in as much as he's one of the Marines. He's not like Ripley.
Mm-hmm.
Or...
He's certainly not. That would have been a different film.
It definitely would. Imagine if he was Ripley. Let's talk about that.
Let's moving on. Back to Near Dark. That's not something I want to spend time thinking about.
I think he's an actor that gets used badly in a lot of places. Almost like Nicolas Cage. Do you know what I mean? Like he has a very sort of Nicolas Cage-ian...
You say used badly, though, but is that not down to their own personal choices a large percentage of the time?
I don't think so, because like if you look at Bringing Out the Dead or like Leaving Las Vegas, Nicolas Cage puts in these sort of beautiful low-key performances and adaptation and other ones like that. Like he can really bring it when he wants to, but if you put him with like a shitty director or someone who doesn't really care, he just like busts out these terrible over the top performances. And I mean Bill Paxton doesn't really do the low key stuff so much or at all. But like
it's not low key, just lower key.
Yeah, like if a good director's got their hands on him, they can really sort of get something out of him more than just him sort of ranting at the camera for an hour and a half, which a lot of people do get out of him.
I mean, I would go as far as to say he is definitely the weak point of Near Dark, but I think the performance is still excusable because it's fantasy. It's not supposed to be completely grounded in reality, because it's not. Vampires aren't real. There's always going to be a certain element where your brain is telling you that this is, you know, this couldn't happen in real life. So I don't know. I don't necessarily think that performance is to the detriment of this film.
I agree.
Okay.
I do.
You don't sound sure.
No, I do. I agree.
Okay. You don't have to agree. It's fine. It's rare, in fact. So go on then. Have you got any more notes? Or anything else you want to say about Bill Paxton before we move on?
No, nothing else on Bill Paxton, really.
Okay.
I think, like, we talked a bit about Kathryn Bigelow, and obviously, mm-hmm. I think she's a great filmmaker. I really do. Like, she's made some things I don't care about so much. She made some things that I love. I think she has a very, what's the word I want to use here?
I think whether you enjoy her films or not, you probably still can't, even if you hate her output, you can't really deny that she knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
With regard to putting a film together.
I think in terms of like her sort of earlier output, at least, what she was sort of looking at genres and really examining them, and that's what she was doing in the films, even up to like the K-19, The Widowmaker. Like, Point Break is almost an examination on action films and breaking those cliches whilst also, like, presenting them.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes off as unintentionally funny at some points, but, like, it's because you're sort of laughing at the awkwardness of, like, here's a fairly, like, prominent homoerotic subtext, and then here's, like, your standard cop FBI action heist movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what that's probably where she did her best work. Like, I don't know about Strange Days. I've not seen that enough times to really analyze it. It seemed very James Cameron-y. I think that was in the point where they were married. As a director, I think what she tries to do is at least like examine the genre and sort of break its conventions whilst also like embracing those conventions and those cliches. And I think that's where she really shines. I've not seen Zero Dark Thirty.
No, nor me.
Or The Hurt Locker. But
you haven't seen The Hurt Locker?
No, I mean, I never got around to it. Like, but I'm not sure if they... I just don't really care about war films. Do you know what I mean? Or, like, films about soldiers.
Okay, that's fair enough. I think you should watch Hurt Locker anyway, though, because it's more about... It's such a character-driven film. It's more about the characters than the setting.
Right. I mean, that's generally how like films about soldiers work, because soldiers like doing stuff is just boring. But like, I just find myself like unable to care, not about the actual films, but just about like seeking them out and watching them, because unless it's in some sort of genre setting which I'm comfortable with, mm-hmm. like very comfortable with, like we're going back to Aliens again, but like the Space Marines and Aliens, or like Starship Troopers.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
Starship Troopers is a much better film than everyone thinks. It's fucking brilliant. And I've had this discussion quite a lot recently where people think it's really bad, but it's not really bad. It's really clever and you don't get it. You're a fucking idiot.
What's Casper Van Dien doing with himself these days?
Last time I saw him in a film, it was Shark Attack 2. So.
Oh, wow.
But he was in the third sequel to Starship Troopers.
Yeah, he was.
I don't know what else.
I'm sure really highbrow stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's due for a Jean-Claude Van Damme style comeback, isn't he?
Give it a couple years. We'll see. It'll probably happen.
But yeah, that's my problem with like war films or like soldier-based films, is I just find it hard to like seek them out. I just find it hard to sort of motivate myself to. And I'm sure The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty are amazing films. Like, they both won a billion Oscars each or whatever.
Yep, that sounds accurate.
I've got too many fucking giallos that I've not seen. Or I can start watching
have
things
to come first.
Yeah, that I, before I have to start watching stuff that I don't really care about.
No, I completely understand. I mean, it's... For people like us, it's difficult. You can't empathise with a character like that, because I know nothing about that lifestyle. I know nothing about that career. It's difficult.
I mean,
to sit down and get into just because of that.
Beyond so that, it's actually something that I like almost actively disagree with as a career path. I find it like doubly difficult to sort of empathise with these characters. Like, if I'm watching Full Metal Jacket. Or, what's the other big one? Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I just don't understand why you're even there. Like, and you're having a horrible time, and that's obvious. But like, if you didn't join the fucking army, then you wouldn't be having a horrible time. You'd be like, working in a sandwich shop, or like, being a haberdasher or something. Like,
I'm sure that was the fallback for most of them.
I know that like, people join the army and it's when there's no other options, or in like Vietnam people were conscripted. I just have no, like, I just think it's a stupid thing to do, to go and join the army and be like, right, I want to sign up where you pay me so I can kill people and maybe get killed.
You are ranty this episode.
I've been holding it in for like however long.
We can't have any more breaks. I can't cope with this. Condensed 5 weeks, condensed rage.
I just think joining the army is a stupid thing to do, and I don't want to watch a film where people make really stupid choices.
Wait, you don't want to watch films where people make stupid choices yet you like horror?
Well, like films where they could be avoided. Like, if you're in a house and you're running away from Michael Myers, you're gonna run up the stairs, because where else are you gonna go? But like, if you're having your legs blown off because you decided one day, I know, I've not got a job, let's join the army. Fully support the troops and all that stuff. Like, I don't want any of them to die. I want them to all come back safe, and I want them to stop all the tyranny and like find all the oil or whatever it is that they're doing. But like, I don't know. I've gone off on a big tangent, and none of this has anything to do with vampires. So. In short, no army. Great guys. Right.
Oh dear.
Let's get back to Near Dark. I've only got one.
Tired now.
I only have one more thing that I want to talk about. Really.
Okay. Thank God.
And that's the ending.
Yes.
The bullshit cop out ending.
Okay.
I mean, it makes a point. Like, if you follow the film, sort of how I read it at first, which is like it's a man, sort of trying to reconcile his manness, his sort of innate like hunter gatherer murderer instincts.
No, let's just go with manness. That works.
Well, these are things that that people believe are hard coded into the male, just as like other things like motherhood and other things like that are hard coded into females. I don't know how much I agree with that, but like if you view this film through that prism, then you sort of end up like he's sort of reconciling his innate manness and trying to sort of break through that to become like a normal person, to become like a guy, and that's what the ending represents to me, despite the sort of bullshitness of it and the blood transfusion-y horse shit, which is just horse shit. I can't stress that enough.
It didn't annoy me as much as it clearly annoyed you.
I mean, it doesn't annoy me because it works with the reading of the film that I've sort of chosen to accept as my own. It makes sense. Like, it works in that narrative. For vampire mythology, it's bullshit. Like,
well, yeah, of course it is. But I mean, it's also worth bearing in mind that they sort of make up their own rules.
Yeah,
a lot of the stereotypical vampire elements are there, but a lot of them aren't. And also, they never actually use the word vampire.
It's true.
Which is probably worth noting.
It reminds me of Max Landis made a short film called The Death of Superman, or The Death of the Death of Superman, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's him sort of ranting about the arc in the comics about the death of Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And he says a part in it where his John Landis' son, and he said, my dad said to me one day, how do you kill a vampire? And I said, stick through the heart, garlic, cut off its head. And he said, you're fucking wrong. Vampires don't exist. You can kill them any way you want. And I guess that kind of stands. But like,
yeah.
I don't know. I think you kind of have to adhere to rules. You have to. Otherwise...
Well, the movie did to a large degree.
We're no different than the animals making vampire films or whatever. Like...
Oh, weird mental image.
I guess that's what they do before they play poker. They play poker to like...
to unwind at the end of the day.
The end of a hard day of making vampire movies.
Yeah, that's what I always figured. It's nice to have that validated. So shall we wrap up then?
Yeah, go on. You do what you want to say about this.
I think you covered most of it. I don't really know what to say, to be honest, other than it's a film that I really enjoy. And it certainly is my favourite vampire film, without question. And I don't know, it's a film I seem to come back to like every few years, and I thought, probably continue to do so.
I thought Vampires Los Muertos was the favourite vampire film of yours, or Dracula 3000.
I do love Dracula 3000. I don't. I'm kidding. I have seen it, though. It's terrible.
Is that the one with Gerard Butler?
I think so.
Or is that Dracula 2000?
Oh, fuck, maybe I'm thinking of Dracula 2000. Wait, what? Oh, no. Where was I?
Favourite vampire film.
Train of thought. Yeah, I don't know. I've said what I need to say, really.
I guess who was in Dracula 3000?
Go on.
Casper Van Dien.
Was he? And we've come full circle.
And Cleo.
I haven't seen it. Maybe I should.
And before. Dirk, yeah, and Tommy Tynister.
Maybe I should watch it before announcing that this is my favourite vampire film. Sounds like that could take the title.
I mean, I don't want to interrupt you too much, but I want to read you the storyline because it's fucking
okay. Be quick.
In the year 3000, the deep space salvage ship Mother 3 locates the vanished starship Dementor of the Carpathian system. Captain Abraham Van Helsing and his crew, composed of the blonde assistant Aurora Ash, the crippled navigator, blah, 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 blah. And the intern, Mina Murray.
All of whom are porn stars, I assume.
While exploring the spacecraft, they see a tape of 50-year-old blah-de-blah He was locked in his cabin since his crew were acting weird after getting a cargo of coffins in Transylvania Station. They searched the coffins to find some hidden dope. He cuts his hand and the blood awakens Count Orlok, aka Count Dracula. When Aurora discloses who Dracula is, the survivors try to find a way to destroy the vampire. That sounds fucking amazing.
Amazing is one word, yep.
I'm going to watch that. If it's on Netflix, I'm going to watch that like immediately. Like, amazing.
Do let me know, because I'm quite keen to watch it myself.
I might choose it for one of our picks next month. Sorry, as podcasts go, this is probably the longest one in existence.
And so maybe even least disciplined, even for us. Yeah, go on, do your wrap up.
Okay, I agree. This is a fucking brilliant vampire film. You can enjoy it on millions of levels. Mm-hmm. There are loads of readings you could take from it.
Or not, if you choose to.
Yeah, or not. Like, you can just watch it as a slab of entertainment.
Yep.
I sort of take the reading that I've explained from it, and I think that stands, or at least is valid. Mm-hmm. And I think it's brilliant, and it's probably a good 7.5, 8 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, I would go with 8.
It's a full-on recommend. If you've not seen Near Dark, you're a fucking Luddite.
I was going to say Belland, but your word is way better.
And even though we went into the spoiler territory,
apparently we're not done.
We didn't actually spoil it. Like, we didn't.
No, we didn't. That's true.
So this might mark a milestone in Gorecast history. The only time we didn't spoil a movie. So maybe this is a new path for us. Or maybe.
It's not.
Probably not, no. Go to gorepress.com and, like, look at stuff that we write sort of sporadically. Content's been a bit lackluster lately because everyone is busy doing everything. Like, it's just crazy.
Content isn't lackluster. The stuff that's been there is great.
You know what I mean.
It's been infrequent.
Yes. Okay. There's been a few reviews in the past couple of weeks. Check those out. They're pretty good. I wrote one of them. Yeah, send us feedback if you can be bothered. Obviously, you can't, so, you know. Stop not sending us feedback or whatever. Next month, we've not fully decided on what's happening. We had a plan. I don't know if that's still happening. So I'm going to talk to you after we're done and see where we are with that.
Let's do that.
And I'll announce it on the Twitter, the Gorecast Twitter, which is at GorecastX.
Yep.
So we'll see you next week. I don't know what music I'm going to choose to play us out, but there'll be some, and it'll probably have started by now. So next week, more of the same. Bye.
Bye.
Stay spooky. It's fun to be a vampire. Whole world is our prey. Party every night and sleep away the day. Times have changed, it's not the same. God is gonna stay. I might just have to stick myself to make them go away. 1,000 years I've walked the earth, but death I've never wished. Endless life is a cruel curse. Company like this, I'd rather face the sun and I'd rather call off my own head. If you think they're annoying when they're alive, see them when they're dead. Fun to be a vampire, our world is our prey. Party every night and sleep away the day. The moon is over Bourbon Street, something's just not right. One more kid in a long black cape and I'll end it all tonight. 1,000 years I've walked the earth, but death I've never wished. Endless life is a cruel curse. Company like this, I'd rather face the